Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Barbara Lawhorn with New Book Network's Pop Culture Podcast, and I'm thrilled to have Fiona Helmsley with us today. We'll be talking about her incredible new collection of essays, Girls Gone Old. Fiona Helmsley's writing can be found online at websites like The Rumpus, Jezebel, The Weaklings, The Hairpin, Pank, and in various anthologies like Ladyland and The Best Sex Writing of the Year, and a multiple Pushcart nominee. Her book of essays and stories, My Body Would Be the Kindest of Strangers, was released in 2015. She's an MFA candidate at L'École des Mœurs. Welcome, Fiona.
Hi.
Well, we'll begin first. Would you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, what I write about is mostly my adventures in the past. Though there are some essays in the new book that have to do with now. Some of my writing takes place in New York City. I moved there in the late 70s and was there on and off for a little bit less than a decade. And while I was there, I had gone there to go to school. The idea was I would go to community college and get my grade point average up, and then hopefully transfer to a film school. But that's not what happened. I had started working in the sex industry. I was always really into punk rock, so it was both those worlds, the punk world and kind of the world of the sex industry. And that went on for about 6 or 7 years. And that tends to be the focus of my writing, those experiences that I had then and the way it led me to see the world and to sort of understand people.
Wonderful. Thank you. I was really struck when I started in with your first piece, My Icon Hates Me. I think for a lot of us who grew up in the 80s and also women especially, I mean, I'm coming to this collection as a 42-year-old woman who's, you know, still making sense of my past as well. And what I loved about this piece was it made me think about being in conversation with those writers, artists, bands who have influenced me in a huge way. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about My Icon Hates Me and where this piece was born from and the way in which it's structured too, because I think it's a really interesting, collage of all of these moments in time for the icon, but also for the narrator as well.
Well, it's a little bit exaggerated. I mean, all of the interactions are based in reality, but I did take it to a level, you know, trying to be a little bit funnier with it. There's a woman, my icon in the story, who to a lot of people I think will be very quite recognizable, though I don't want to say who she is, who had really influenced me as a young woman. I'd read her writing. She performed in bands. And when I moved to New York, she was pretty accessible. But she was always very standoffish, as I think comes across in the essay. And it's also, I don't say it as much in the essay, but it was very much in my mind when I was writing it. I mean, I was influenced by people like Kathleen Hanna and Courtney Love and Kat Bajelan from Babes in Toyland, and Lydia Lunch. Mm-hmm. And what was funny about those women specifically, was they would talk about it in the media and you would see it in interviews. They all hated each other. Like they were thought of as, well, Lydia's a little bit before Riot Girl, but I mean, Kat and Courtney and Kathleen were all very much considered, you know, to different extents, to be part of like the Riot Girl scene, which was supposed to be like this idea of, you know, women's empowerment and, you know, sisterhood and whatnot. And these three specific women did not like each other. Courtney Love punched Kathleen Hanna in the face.
Yes.
Lydia Lunch used to talk. Courtney was very, you know, obvious about how she'd been influenced by Lydia. And Lydia would say all these things about Courtney. So it was just funny that out of that whole, you know, scene of Riot Girl, the women in it who I latched on to happened to be women who were so upfront about their dislike for each other. But in my real life, the woman in the story, you know, I tried to reach out to her a bunch of different times, because as I kept writing, you know, the hope is that, you know, this person who has such an influence, who had had such an influence on me, you know, might maybe want to talk to me, might want to, you know, not necessarily think of me as a peer. I mean, she had so, her history was so, is so much more vast than mine, but it was just, she was always very, you know, kind of get away from me.
So a couple of things come up for me as I was listening to you. Can you talk a little bit about, because especially with creative nonfiction, and you were saying that emphasizing the humor and maybe, you know, pushing it and exaggerating it a little bit in terms of craft, right? So that it becomes this made thing. It is about what happened in specific events, but it also becomes art, right? It's artfully constructed,
right.
and it is so funny. But it also gets at these really interesting tensions about what does it mean to be influenced by others, and what does it mean to be in conversation with them, and competition in
right.
some ways, you know?
Right.
And so I wonder if you could talk as a writer, too, about how you kind of juggle all of those things at once, and how do you know when a piece is finished, too? Because this piece, it just came to me as I was reconsidering it this morning that the way it's woven together, it is really sophisticated. It's a really sophisticated piece of writing. And so using all of that and still making it feel so real.
Right.
And of that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I definitely obsess over my writing. And to go back to like what I changed to make it funnier, like in the essay, I ask her to contribute to a blog that I'm doing. On, you know, like writers' sweaters, like having writers and artists send me pictures of their sweaters. In real life, I do a blog of writers' shoes. And
That's
I did
awesome.
Reach out to her to ask her to send me a picture of her shoes. But I changed it to sweaters because I thought that would be more funny. I mean, that would be an example of how I switched it up a little bit. But I obsess over my writing. Like, I just obsess. When something's done is... I just have this weird thing that I do. I think a lot of writers have like their weird little things. I'll write something on my computer and then I send it to my phone. And when I'm reading it on my phone, like on that little screen, when I can read it on my phone, on my little screen, and it seems done to me, that's when I'm done. It's just my own little weird thing.
I love it.
Yeah, but that's how I...
But I think what I also found really interesting about this was... looking at technology and the live journal, the piece where you talk about the live journaling, And it made me think about, oh my gosh, how far we have come,
Right.
technologically speaking. And that, you know, like before Google, you know, when I say to students, you know, well, BG, and they're like, what's that? And I'm like, well, before Google, and it is something that they can't conceive of,
Right.
really,
You're
because they
right.
haven't known that. But it brought back to me just so many ideas, and the dial-up modems, things that I had legitimately kind
Like
of, I think.
when webcams were like,
Yes.
yeah.
It was like cutting edge.
But going back to like your icons, and that's another thing about the internet. Your icons, for lack of a better word, are like completely accessible now. I mean,
Yes.
if they play into the internet, I mean, you can, like I mentioned, when I was younger, my interest in Courtney Love, like she would comment on my Facebook page. So it's funny that that is so different now. These people that you look up to, usually they have to do it if they're in the arts in some way. They have to have some kind of presence online, and they're just totally accessible. And for a long
Yes.
time, I was one of those people who, if I I found out somebody that I really looked up to, was like active on the internet, I would be right there emailing them and. Not trying to be annoying,
Right.
but I guess looking for that kind of connection. But in that essay, my icon hates me. But and the woman who that's about has always been. It wasn't just, Courtney Love who she was out about not liking. She if you go through old interviews with her, she's just very much like an island to herself when she comes to other women. I mean, she's
Right.
there's this old feminist term, male identified, and she's kind of male identified. There's nothing the matter with that, but it's just
Right.
her way.
Do you feel any pressure to be accessible in that big way too?
I for a long time, if anybody messaged me, usually I would message them back. I mean, this is through Facebook because it's so easy. And I
Right.
don't like to be rude, but you know what? A lot of these people were rude. So, not so much anymore. Especially people who will message me and be like, "Oh, send me a link to your, send me a link to something you've written." I mean, to even ask that when you can just go into Google and type somebody's
Exactly.
name. I mean, that's so profoundly lazy,
Yes.
and insulting. But yeah, I mean, I've backed away from the internet lately. I don't find the internet to be as much fun as I used to. So I'm like in just this weird spot with my online presence right now. Probably because I need to do it more, like for writing and book stuff, like trying to push me as a product. That's probably what
Right.
makes me back away from it. So I'm
Which
just in a weird
is,
place with it.
yeah, and that's a such a different space than the space of writing your life in order to share it, where that initial the Internet Odyssey, 2002, and the Internet Odyssey, the way that it really worked, I think, in some ways in the beginning to really connect with to connect in a brand new way with
Right.
others that you might not ever connect with,
Right. And
you know.
just trying to figure it out. Well, I have a child. I have a son and he's 12. And I see how much value he puts on, like he's on YouTube a lot. And if somebody has like 5,000 subs, he thinks that that
Yes.
means that they have some great validity. And I think it's like the
Yes.
worst validity, I mean, usually the group mind is like the mind you want to stay away from. But and I see how him and people his age think that that is just the mark of something worthwhile, and that just makes me cringe so
Right.
hard.
It
Yeah.
is. It is so hard. You know, speaking of validity in Girls Gone Old, I love the tension in this piece between, oh, there's a section that I had marked that, you know, this idea about really wanting to I'm trying to find it because I have lots of places that
Yep, the marks.
I had marked it because it's so good, but this idea of, you know, wanting to be seen, wanting also to know, oh, here it is, It's on page 24. Since I chose to do this, I can say upon reflection, the gains were pretty meager. I ended up having to deal with more fuckers than fans, and in the communications I had with a lot of the male readers of my writing, that undercurrent was always there and never really seemed to morph into anything more substantial. Yes, they wanted to fuck me, false success, but it never really evolved, as far as I could tell, into some deeper appreciation of my work, real success. I've learned that women can use their physicality, but they will never be able to control what happens once they do. Once I turned them on, it was hard to turn them off. It was hard to get them to focus. It was hard to get them to read. I love that.
Because so sad.
It is, but it's that whole.
Yeah, no, it's so true, but it's so sad. I remember I saw this video once of Paris Hilton, and it was the height of her fame. This was when she was, you know, she was Kim Kardashian. Mm-hmm. And it was a video of her in a hot tub with, and Joe Francis, who's in that essay, was the one making the video. And he's saying to her, and she's in the hot tub, and she's like covered in bubbles, I think. And he's saying to her, come on, come on, Paris, show me your tits. Show me your tits, France. Why do I keep wanting to call her Francis? Show me your tits, Paris. And I'm thinking to myself, this is the most famous woman in the world. And you would think with her fame would come some kind of power or some kind of protection. But still, she, most famous person in the world, and she's not telling this guy to get away from me. Shut up. Yes. She was still trying to play the sexy girl for him in the bathtub. And it just struck me as so profoundly sad. I don't know. I mean, maybe the goal of, you know, fame and recognition and that isn't to not have to deal with yourself, you know, in a physical or sexual way. But you would like, no, you don't. And with women, you always have to. You always have to. You never break free of that. People will always expect that from you.
It's so true. And then when you're talking about old, you know, maybe if I hadn't defaulted to it as often as I did, quote, old wouldn't carry any sting. Maybe if I hadn't defaulted to it, old wouldn't make me feel like someone was trying to take something from me. I mean, I think in my 40s, that feeling of, you know, of being old, right, you know, or being identified as being old, where I'm like, I feel so young. Right, you know, I still feel... feel more physically in my body, at home in my body, than I ever have. But it does feel like, you know, this idea that you talk about, that physicality, that sexuality, even if it is not seen, it becomes something of, you're an age where it is ignored or not seen. But this idea of being in the passenger seat in some way, like, even when we try to control it, when we try to drive it, when we try to be in charge of it and use it, that line where you said, but I'm starting to wonder if I was always just the passenger, was really, I thought, profound. You know, it is one of those things that comes up in conversation for me with other women.
Right. Right. And as you, and I'm 40, and as much as I never, I mean, I guess I can't say that I didn't. There, as I try to say in the essay, there are some times where it can feel good to be objectified. You know, it can make you feel like a weird kind of accomplishment in some way, which is the only thing that I can think of to compare it to, as some kind of accomplishment, weird three-dimensional accomplishment. But you start to notice when it changes, you know, when you're walking down the street and guys aren't leering at you, no matter how disgusting that is. You know, it's maybe it's just the change of it that is, you know, hard to wrap your mind around. It can feel like some kind of death, which is so horrible. And it's also horrible to be aware of the whole structure at play, to think it's gross.
Yes.
To also, you know, have to operate in it. I mean, to not operate in it, you know, especially as an artist, is to make a sacrifice, you know, because there is a currency to being desired. That's what it comes down to. It's something that you can trade to get your work out there, to get people interested. You know, and it's not on us. It's patriarchy. You know,
yes.
It's not on us. You know, these are the cards that we've been dealt, and just trying to navigate it and being aware of what we're doing. You know?
Yes. Yes. But I did love the Golden Girls reference. I got it.
Yeah.
Can you talk about too? So 12 flash nonfictions. Can you first tell me about how you see flash operating differently from kind of the traditional essay?
Well, I don't do a lot of it. So there was some, you know, it was different to try to do something small and really concise. Some of them have been Facebook statuses that I, you know, like tweaked a little bit. I was just trying to go for something that I thought was, to say something is profound seems a little egotistical, but I was trying to go for something that had like a little bit of resonance, but you know, in a small little package. I don't do it that often. I tend to be quite a wordy person.
These pieces, though, are like, oh, I mean, I was thinking in terms of almost a haiku, where these were the ones that they bloomed for me while I was walking my dog. Like they would come back to me and reverberate, and the accumulated effect of all 12 coming together does, I mean, it does feel profound. The way that all 12 of these pieces do come together, and these echoes and reverberations, and thematically, it's lovely and beautiful,
yeah,
and funny too.
Right. I can't think of what they all are. I know that there's, you know, there's a few about when I was a child, you know, my parents, my father was an alcoholic. They tend to be a little bit sad, but I know that there are some funny ones in there. There's one about my grandmother before she died.
Yes.
Yeah, one about my child's father.
Mm-hmm. So can I ask you, because I think humor is really hard. It's hard to write well and not have it feel forced. Does that come naturally to you, Fiona, or is that something that you've actively cultivated?
No, I think I'm definitely, my default is like self-deprecation. And it's like the spoonful of sugar, you know, to like sort of make the medicine go down. I think humor can be really good to get people to give something, you know, a second look that they might not have, you know, maybe if they thought the subject matter might be too heavy or too, you know, too kind of off-putting. If you, you know, give them the hook of the humor, they might be more open to it.
So we'll talk a little bit about 2002 and Internet Odyssey, and the subject matter, I think, this is one where there is humor. I'm thinking like just your live journal handle, you know, of crack pipe. Where it's really funny, but it's also
right.
It's really not funny too.
Well, it's not. It's an interesting choice. I mean, it was just one of those spur of the moment things. My friend had, as I say in the essay, had sent me a link to the site I knew nothing about. And, you know, comes up on the screen, you know, come up with a login name. So I probably never even expected to really use the site. So, but the funny thing is, I mean, of all the drugs that I abused and made big parts of my life for so long, you know, I mean, there were some crack moments, but crack was not, you know, my first and foremost.
I mean, I think in writing about writing so viscerally, or as Mary Carr would say, you know, carnally, about really difficult subject matter that I think a lot of people want to avert their gaze from.
Right, but and that's where I think the humor can be.
Yes.
Can be the hook.
Because it is, I think these preconceived notions people have about about addiction, that the humor, the vast intelligence, the emotional and intellectually that's here, it's a fascinating piece. Well, go ahead.
Well, I tried to, I mentioned Werner Herzog there towards the end.
Yes.
You know, and there's, I think it, with the memoir genre becoming so vast, and so many of them having to do with addiction and things like that. I mean, people probably couldn't say that the drug addicts are not intelligent people. I mean, that would be an immensely ignorant thing to
say.
But I try to throw that, especially, it's not throwing, it's natural because it's my life. But when I write about drugs or the sex industry, I do try to throw some like intellectual ideas into the essays because I do have them. I have lots of them.
Of course. So, and I hope that I was not that.
No. Oh no.
That
no.
The way that yeah.
I didn't take it that way at all.
Because I thought that blending though of Grizzly Man, which that ending in the film. Is so gutting,
right.
You know, and
you must never listen to this.
Yes.
No, you must never. Yeah.
But I think too, the genre of the memoir and if as a writer, I mean, as a writer, you are always confronted with past work. And also I think that not being necessarily completely defined by it, but this idea of also, you know, moving forward and what comes next in terms of writing. And I just know that rereading work that of the past, that encapsulates who I really was at that time too, can be so, so painful. And that's what I think that you capture here that is so universal
right.
for me,
just
is the tenderness of that. Yeah.
Well, and the horrifying realization that you were, at least for me, I was so, that was my presence, you know, the whole time I was on LiveJournal. I was just like this, I don't even know. I was just so, like, I just don't even know. That poor girl, that's all I can say. You know, I just like, put it all out there. And it's interesting for me to go back and look at that because it's not contrived. I mean, I think a lot of the internet now is performance.
Yes. Construction. Complete.
Right.
Yeah.
And I definitely wasn't performing. I guess that's what I thought like my best self was reaching out to others in the world. It's interesting.
But there's something I think so brave about that.
Yeah.
You know, there's something so, and that comes across in the essay that it isn't, it's not contrived.
Yeah.
It's really like this act of absolute courage, I think, to like present yourself as you are, you know, as you conceive of yourself, truly.
Yeah.
I think there's something really courageous about it.
Yeah. I mean, I could see that maybe if it's not you, like if it's not, you looking back at it. I mean, and there
right.
are people. Half the people that I were friends with on LiveJournal were like gawkers, like gawking at this girl who was just, you know, totally out there about, you know, not having any kind of filter or sense of dignity or, you know,
mm-hmm.
And it's funny because I'd met some of those people on LiveJournal and I'm still friends with them on different social networks and I've met them. And they tell me that, you know, they're amazed. And they say nice things, like they could see in my crazy writing that there was some talent there, but they never really thought that it would get any, you know, they thought that I would probably, you know, fall back into, you know, using drugs and you know, being a mess. So
speaking about dignity, I love in California Dreaming, the way that you present Christine, she's such a full character who comes to life in a way that has so much dignity.
Yeah.
I think even though the circumstances sometimes, I think some of her actions, a lot of people from the outside looking in would see as undignified, but like the ham under the bed, like I got that.
Right.
I got why the ham? Well, yeah.
I mean, she was, I had worked at a woman's halfway house. I worked there for almost like 8 years. And she, I didn't, like I say in the essay, I didn't have many interactions with her. And she was obviously, I mean, to be easy about it, you know, she was just a mentally ill person who was, mm-hmm. who could be manipulative. But I've always, I'm not so easy to dismiss that. Like, I can think that there could almost be, like, this is probably going to sound pretentious, and I wouldn't want to sound like I'm saying this from, like, a perch of privilege, like I'm, you know, treating somebody like a cartoon character. But there can be almost, like, a poetry to that. I mean, some people would probably just say she was a liar. She was just this crazy liar. But I don't know. She had, like, I guess warmed my heart a little bit, and then she died. So, I mean, we didn't have any great friendship or relationship.
Right.
But she was just somebody who I thought had an interesting mind, I guess. And I think comes through in the essay, even though, you know, I describe how she was, you know, so overweight and so, you know, had a heart, was having so all these health issues. I mean, still would, like, talk about California and getting back to California. And, you know, so obviously she still had some belief in herself, whether maybe that was delusion and lies, but I don't know. She was somebody who I found myself thinking about, and I wrote the essay.
It's a beautiful essay. It really, that ending for me, that, going ahead and taking the chances and calling Detective Jones, because I think without being overt and like sledgehammery with it, it's that the dignity and the worth of her life, you
right.
know, that it's inherent, you know, and this was a piece that I was really moved by, Fiona. It's moving without being like sentimental,
right.
you know, or you don't make more of your relationship, like the way that you just characterized it. It's there on the page.
Right. And I didn't want to say, I thought it was important to like cut it. I didn't want to say like what I, you know, what it said in her file or, you know, most people can probably draw their own conclusions, you know?
Right.
But I just wanted to leave it like that.
And that kind of the glimpsing of humanity that comes to in that piece, and I think it's like you're the way that Ghoul Girl grows up just seems like it should follow that essay, is beautifully done, because that piece too feels like it's about understanding in a complex way what's behind, like the true horror. The
right.
true horror of what we construe as kind of the glamorization of Manson or serial killers or the narrative that crops up without understanding that violence.
Yeah,
go ahead.
It becomes like entertainment. Before Donald Trump was elected, because now all I do is watch MSNBC like 24 hours a day. I used to watch a lot of Investigation Discovery, which I call the crime channel, because that's all it is. It's, you know, different crime shows, different murders. And I mean, this connects to the essay. When you're watching those shows, you're turning to this, whether you want to admit to it or not, it's for entertainment.
Yes.
The end of people's lives, and sometimes like in very horrible ways, you're like escaping through that. And I think you kind of forget that, you know, when it's coming
yes.
through the television, you forget that these are people's realities. And it's interesting sometimes, too, because lately, on and off in the media, you'll have the family members of these people whose lives have been made into these hour shows on Investigative Discovery, you know, coming out against the shows, because the families don't even have any say as to whether or not these happen. So, I mean, imagine what that's like. You turn on the television and it's, you know, an hour drama about the murder of your mother, and you have no control over that. But when I was younger, I was always really interested in crime, and I still am now. When I would read Helter Skelter, because that's essays about initially my fascination, for lack of a better word, with Charles Manson, I didn't. The murders, what he was most known for, really wasn't what I focused on when it came to my interest in him. Mm-hmm. It was more the trappings of, you know, 60s culture, a group of people living sort of communally, all the bizarre tangents that sprung from Manson and his group. The murders were really, it was something that I kept very distant. It was, you know, it was, mm-hmm. it wasn't in the forefront of my mind what their claim to fame really was, which doesn't seem to make sense. There's like a disconnect. There was definitely a disconnect with that. And then I write later on, you know, I started going out with a guy who sold serial killer artwork, which was just totally coincidental. I mean, I didn't search him out because of I had had that interest. It was just like organic that's what he did. And so I ended up, and he would sell artwork that he would buy from them, and letters and things like that. So he hooked me up with Richard Ramirez, and I wrote him a letter, and he wrote back to me. And then that's where the end of the essay comes from, where I'm confronted with the fact who this is who's written to me and what they've done and just how like gross it was.
And who you would be if you continued.
Right.
Yeah.
Like I, what is the appeal of this man? He's in a cage because he's, you know, brutally killed however many people. I mean, mm-hmm. that's to reward that is, you know, that's not who I am.
Right. I think that, like, I totally understand the fascination with Manson and the 60s culture. And also, I mean, I love mysteries, and it's all about that figuring out why we do what we do.
Right.
And why and how we are capable of what we're capable of, which seems to me is also the job of the essayist.
Right.
You know, right. For themselves and their place in the world. And
there were so many weird threads with the Manson thing. The idea of the race war, starting this race war and making it look like the Black Panthers did it. And it's funny, I mean, for the period of time that I was really interested in Charles Manson, like the period of time I had my Charles Manson scrapbook, which I write about in the essay, I talked to Vincent Bogliosi. If I'm interested in something, I really go for it. Who had been the prosecutor. You know, he was on some radio program, and I called in, and we talked for a little while. I was like 14.
That's awesome.
But yeah, so it's just, it really, I mean, I think that sounds bizarre, but the murders were like probably the last thing that really interested me about Manson.
How do you get hooked, Fiona, by subject matter, typically? Because, you know, you talked about when you get into something, you really get into it, and the research and the coming to know.
I have about 5 real obsessions a year. I was thinking about it the other day, because right now I'm in the middle of this really big Leslie Howard obsession. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He was an actor in the 30s and 40s. He played Ashley in Gone with the Wind.
Yes.
He was a British actor, and he died when his plane was shot down by the Nazis in like 1943. So I'm in the middle of this, and my obsessions are totally diverse. They're all over the place, but I usually have about 5 a year. When I did my first book, I was obsessed with Mark Bolan. Mark Bolan, who was the main dude in the band T-Rex.
Yes.
So I was obsessed with him, and I get super obsessed, you know, and I'm 40 years old, and obsession to me means all the things that it means when, like, you're a kid. Obsession to me means you go and you order the posters.
Yes.
Go and you get the t-shirts. You know, I don't have that much disposable income, but usually that's where my disposable income will go. You know, so I had the Mark Molin obsession, the bank robber John Dillinger. I've gone through obsessions with him more than once because that's just so interesting. Joan Crawford was a recent obsession.
yes.
But right now it's definitely Leslie Howard. Just watching his old movies. You know, I've ordered like glossy pictures from eBay. You know, just trying to find out as much about him as I can because I just think he's so dashing.
Yes, he is.
I mean, and it's funny because I was talking to somebody about it the other day. But I'm trying to think, like, lineage-wise, like, who would be an actor who would be, I guess, sort of comparable? And I don't watch a lot of, like, big movies. I don't watch, like, a lot of popular movies. Mm-hmm. And an actor who I had the awareness that would be kind of similar, but isn't anyone who interests me in any way, would probably be, like, a Hugh Grant. He kind of has, like,
right.
Hugh Grant kind of dashing, funny, foppish, like foppy thing to
yep.
him. So I don't know. I love him though.
Do you see any writing coming out of it?
I would like to write something about Joan Crawford.
Yeah.
Actually, what I'm working on now is something about Casey Anthony. Our children, her daughter who died, is the same. Would if she was still alive, it would be the same. We both had kids in 2005. And, you know, her relationship with her mother was so intense. It's my relationship with my mother is also very intense. And when that verdict, when that happened, when her trial went on, I was working at the halfway house. I was working with women who had lost their children. And as somebody who'd been a drug addict up until I had my own child, I always had this awareness of, you know, you need to get your shit together. You don't get your shit together, you know, you could lose your child. So the essay is about just all of that, the confluence of all of that. And then Joan Crawford, just because of what had happened to her with Mommy Dearest. And
yes.
It may not seem like where it connects, but it does connect. Because I also talk about other women who have been accused of being bad mothers, like Britney Spears when she drove with the baby in the car seat, Anna Nicole Smith, and then Anna died after the birth of her second child. And then it just connects to Nancy Grace. And
I can't wait to read it. I cannot wait.
Got a lot of different layers. And the funny thing, like the nut graph of it sort of is, when she was found to be not guilty, I was so angry. I like to think of myself as so open-minded and not somebody who's influenced by the media. I like to think that I take media, I listen to it, and I process it on my own. But I can admit now, however many years after the verdict, where are we? That was like 2011, where I don't. You know, 6 years ago, I don't think she killed her child. I absolutely believe it was probably an accident. But at the time, I was just so, I will admit to it in the essay, and it embarrasses me, but I was so influenced by the media. And I think it was also my own worries about having a child and being a good mother that it just made me very distrustful of her, the way that I saw her in the media. And the essay is kind of admitting to, you know, how wrong I think that I was then and how it, you know, makes me mad at myself that I wasn't more
open. It's such fertile ground though, because I think it's not until you are in that weird new terrain of being a mother and you understand that the judgments that are so easy to cast, like what makes a good mom, what makes a bad mom,
right?
That suddenly as a human being who's also now a mom, like you understand the complexity. It's so deeply complex and we want it to be easy, you know?
Well, and I think especially with Casey, I think her relationship with her mother played into so much about what happened and the way she handled what I believe was an accident with her daughter. I think she was just so, through all of her life, her relationship with her mother had been so toxic, and she was so afraid of letting her mother down, you know, and saying, calling the police and saying this horrible accident happened. And actually, after, when it's believed that Casey, that Kaylee, her daughter, went missing, like the hour that they believe that it happened, Casey did try to call her mother. She tried to call, there's like three phone calls, and she doesn't get her mom on the phone. So I think that in those moments, Casey did try to, she did try to reach out to her family and say something horrible's happened, but she didn't get her mother on the phone. And then I think she just went back into her shell of being so afraid of letting her mother down. And it just snowballed into this huge thing.
And fear, I think fear makes us retreat.
Right. And that's the worst thing as a mother, you can, as a woman, you can be, is a bad mother. I mean, that is, you know, you're, bad mother is a label that it's very hard to come back from.
Absolutely.
And that's where Joan Crawford would fit in to it too.
Well, I think in talking about, in addressing fear too, in Killing Me Softly on Elliot Rodger and The Power of No, I thought this was such a compelling piece that made me think about the small no's, what no has cost.
Yeah.
You know, that idea, small no, consequence, suck it up, move on. But the implications of, you know, that idea of no means no, and then how even the way that we try to negotiate and soften the small no's and make it like digestible.
Right. It's
and
not
okay.
You. Yeah. It's not yeah, you, uh-huh. it's me.
Right.
Right.
And it made me really think, this is a part of your work that made me feel deeply connected, was that reviewing and reflecting upon instances in my life where I think a lot of readers will do this, where they see those small no's in a new way, realize, oh, yeah, you know, that that resounding, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Or just even the little times. I was talking to somebody the other day who is like in a position of power over me, and, you know, I'm not going to say if it's I work with him or whatever it is, but he's a person who in my daily life is, you know, somebody who holds a little bit of power over what I do. And I realized he was quoting somebody. Was it Nietzsche? I can't even remember. Or he said it was Nietzsche. And I knew that it wasn't. I knew it was like Oscar Wilde. But I didn't correct him because I knew that he, you know, he probably could, for me to correct him, even in a small way about something like that, I had a feeling that he wouldn't be able to take that well. So I, you know, I just let that go. You know, and there's just, men are strange. Men are, you know, as women, with awareness, and I think most women have awareness, you do learn to navigate them to a certain degree. I mean, in the smallest ways. You know, it's
right. No, the fact that, I mean, I'll just say, like, theoretically in a meeting, right, where you do think about that before you respond to a response, you know, like the gentleman, hypothetical guy who is quoting Nietzsche or whatever, you know, that the amount of energy that goes into thinking about the negotiation of that.
Right.
You know,
and the reality of it would be he would be insulted that me, like an underling to him,
yes,
would be the person who would be, you know, correct in that situation. I'm writing another essay now about something, another like small incidents of, you know, I have this poster on my wall, an Andy Warhol poster, Women in Revolt. And a friend of mine was looking at it, another man. And he had said to me, you know, Robert De Niro was in an Andy Warhol film. And I knew that he hadn't been. I knew that he'd been like in a Jackie Curtis play. Jackie Curtis is in Women in Revolt, the poster I have at the wall. And I said to him, oh, you know, and I said it to him very gently, you know, not wanting to offend his fragile ego, you know, with that fact that I might be right about something, you know, and he that which would make him wrong. That, you know, I think you mean he was in a Jackie Curtis play. And he was like, oh, well, you know, we'll Google it later. We'll get back to this. You know, men are just very fragile beings. And, you know, a lot of it's navigation.
Yes. I know that I want to definitely talk about the rape book, which I thought also is such it's such a high octane, I think, an inquiry into these ideas that we have when we're really young, and that like that deep investigation of trying to figure out what was the rape book. Do you want to, just so listeners know, maybe kind of tell us a little bit about the origins of this notebook?
Well, when I was a kid, a friend and I had made a notebook, and it was just essentially what it was just a list of guys that we thought were cute. But the way that we had phrased it was that these were men that we wanted to rape us. You know, that was the language that we used, obviously not meaning it.
Right.
But and the essay is just about, you know, exploring the idea of that. Because in my mind, and in the essay I go into this, you know, trying to figure out where it came from, like through TV shows and this and that, I had thought of male aggression as like a compliment. Like if somebody was a caveman in their approach to you, that it wasn't that they were, you know, troglodytes. It was that they couldn't control their desire for you. So the essay is just trying to like trace where how those ideas got into my head. through TV shows, you know, in the essay I mention Mork and Mindy,
yes,
and an episode of Little House on the Prairie,
and Axl Rose,
and Axl Rose, and, you know, how I saw, you know, some of his lyrics, specifically the lyric from It's So Easy, where he says, you know, you get nothing for nothing, if that's what you do, turn around, you know, bitch, I got a use for you. Like, I thought that that was, like, an opportunity. Like, to me, that sounded like, but it was about, the essay's about shame. It's about the shame of being a young woman with an interest in sex, and how I started to, you know, in my juvenile mind, you know, have these, it's about the origins of what have been called rape fantasies. That's what the essay's about, in my, you know, super wordy way.
But I think, and I think about this piece is that it is, I think for a lot of people, that kind of resounding yes, that like, yeah, oh, you know, there will be relief, I think, for a lot of readers. You know, like understanding your journey and understanding this notebook and the origins of the notebook, to be able to reflect on whatever their journey and understanding sexuality is, there will be, you know.
Well, it's really funny for me because I grew up in like a very feminist household. My mom didn't let us have Barbie dolls because she thought that they would do something to our body images. Like when I was 8, there was this big Seneca Falls, this like famous women's gathering in protest of like this like nuclear power plant. So my mother very much had that ideology, but as I say in the essay, there's a great Maggie Nelson quote, you know, if you're a young girl and you're looking for information about sex and you're not really finding it from people you should be able to trust or people who would be good guides, your sexuality will grow around what you see and what you do find. And it would have been great, you know, to have had a little bit of guidance to, you know, have somebody when I was watching Mork and Mindy, you know, say to me that this isn't, you know, this isn't how men should respond to women when they desire them. And it's okay for women to want to be desired. You know, yes. I didn't get that. So I had to try to figure it out for myself, and it got a little warped in there. But what's funny, I write in that essay about Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees.
Yes, from the Monkees.
Yes. And as the book was being published, I met him.
You did? How did that go?
Which is like, I'm convinced I'm going to die because I've met Mickey Dolenz. So like, what else is left? It was great. I have to say, like, he sounded awesome. He's like 73. He was on stage, like, totally rocking out. And he sounded good. He's like, voice
awesome.
Sounded awesome. So then afterward, you could, like, you could meet him. You know, you had to buy, like, a $20 photo. And it was so sad. Like, after that, he was having another meet and greet at, like, the Quality Inn. I mean, the Quality, yeah. Not even the Hilton. The Quality Inn. So I went up to the table. And I didn't, I was thinking about it afterward. I didn't have copies of my book yet. But if I had, would I have given him one? I think I would have, because that's what I do.
Yes.
But I said to him, you know, you were my first love. And he's like looking at me, and I'm sure he hears that all the time. You know,
yeah.
He was that for a lot of women of different generations. And he was like, oh, you look a little, he was like, you look a little too young for, you know, the first wave. And I was like, well, you know, I was on Nickelodeon. I caught you on Nickelodeon.
The first wave of the Monkees. Oh, no. I love it.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of, when I was first picking up this book and reading the back cover, you know, the question that your friend had asked you about the subject matter of your writing, you know, wasn't 40 a good age to grow up and move on to more mature subject matter rather than, you know, delving into the past? And I wonder, especially as I was reading, playing the Donald Trump game, I mean, I know that this is dealing with the past and your past, and yet it seems so intimately connected and necessary to understanding, like, right, the right now.
Right.
And the kind of the terror of right now.
Right.
You know?
You know what I think people really need to think of when it comes to Donald Trump? The man does not have a dog. Like, I don't think the man's ever had a dog. And I think that's that I think is says so much about, you know, if you're going to go to Donald Trump for any kind of warmth.
Right.
You know, and I would love to see how dogs would react to them, because animals are so great about, people.
Yes, and intuiting who they are.
Right. I would love to see a pack of dogs.
That, you know, that slogan, it's not whether you win or lose, it's whether you win that's on the box of the game,
yeah.
You know? And I think, too, the that word bigly. That
yeah.
You used.
Yeah.
I was just like, yes.
They have
I've met so many biglies.
Well, they've released the transcripts now. That's what the news are talking about. These and I think it's Sean Spicer doing this now. Sean Spicer, now that he's been canned, you know,
yes.
And I'm sure he's totally resentful and angry. But I wouldn't be surprised if some of the leaks are coming from Spicy. But they're doing the transcripts of his telephone conversations with the president of Mexico and the president of Australia. And it's just, it's so mortifying. I mean, we know he's mortifying anyway, but there's big leagues all over the place in the transcripts.
Yes.
Yeah. So he's just, it's, I mean, I'm obsessed with it, but I feel like I just want to be so informed. Like I want to mm-hmm. know, I want to be totally up to the moment with whatever the fuck he's doing.
Yes.
So I don't think he's doing much of anything. I think he's just, you know, out on the stage. He's never been one for quality.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not anybody who's beating himself up when he hears back these mortifying transcripts of his phone conversations. I mean, that doesn't even register, you know, for him as something
yes.
that he needs to work on. But, you know, the hope is there that, you know, it ends soon because it's just brought up such ugliness, you know, and it's even more ugly that, you know, like yesterday when he's talking about, you know, making all these revisions to immigration, the likelihood is that's not going to happen. You're not going to get 60 votes in the Congress for that to happen. But he goes on TV and he just introduces these new ugly ideas that he knows are never going to happen. And it's like chum for his base.
Yes.
He's just feeding his base ugliness that he knows will please them. Mm-hmm. And it's just so horrible. So horrible.
Well, your concluding piece, I think it's at really, in a really personal way, you know, this idea that of geography being what can determine healthcare, you know, and what I also loved about this piece, which focuses on, you know, you becoming hepatitis C free, right, is also the beautiful relationship, complex, albeit really complex, with Callie too, that's handled really beautifully. And you're able to braid all of these together with, you know, what's happening in our world right now, you know, and how, you know, it does determine the state you live in determines
whether or not you could live or die.
Yes.
You know, a drug test could determine, you know, because I say in some states you have to pass drug tests in order to get to qualify for the treatment for hepatitis C. So a drug test could determine whether or not you live or die. I mean, the stark reality of that is it's absolutely bone chilling. To see the Republicans just scramble in their attempts to, you know, take health care away from millions of people. It's really ugly. And that's what the world we're, that's our society right now on the forefront.
Yes.
Just so much ugliness and it's class war stuff.
Yes.
I mean, all of this is class war. That's what's going on. You know, when they talk about, you know, low-skilled immigrants coming to the country and taking away jobs from, people who, citizens with low skills, you know, it's putting that on, it's the immigrants who are doing this. It's not the corporations who pay poverty wages and are so resistant to raising the minimum wage. You know, those are the people who, you know, and that's the Republican Party too. They never want to regulate anything. It's always the people who get the brunt of whatever their policy changes will be. They'll never regulate corporations or big business. They'll just regulate people.
Yes.
You know?
I have to say, Fiona, I'm so grateful for your time and for the fact that through these beautiful, compelling essays, you're bringing to so many readers' eyes exactly where we are at and also where you've been in such an artful way. So I thank you so much for your time. Can you tell us where we can find you online and what you're up to next?
Well, I'm really bad at the internet. Like, I'm in a moment where I'm kind of bad with it. I do have a Tumblr page that I don't update very often. Like, lately, I just put on, like, clips from Joan Crawford movies. But that's FionaHelmsley.com. And I mentioned the shoe project, where I was putting up pictures of writer's shoes. That's just shoes of a writer at Tumblr.com. Or I think it's actually just shoesofawriter.com.
Thank you so, so much for your work and for your time today. I so enjoyed speaking with you. And I so enjoyed reading your collection. And again, that is Girls Gone Old, Essays by Fiona Helmsley, available now. So please keep your eye out for that and pick it up. So worth the read.
Thanks
Thank
for
you,
having
Fiona.
Me.